You want it back or? Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to our fifth lesson tonight. And tonight, our lesson is titled The Eternal Bond. We're going to start with the movie and people will come in. That's what we'll do. Everybody's supposed to show up tonight besides Ed. Ed is going to Texas in the morning, so he's got a pack. Okay, so we're going to start with the video. Have that, movie time. And then we'll begin the course.
So often, when they feel alone, the bereaved pour out their hearts to their deceased loved ones, whether in grave sites or the quiet of their own homes. Is this just wishful thinking? Is it really possible to reach out across the great chasm that divides our world from theirs, communicating our love and caring to those who have passed on?
When I talk to my father, and every morning high and every night, there's a picture of her in my room. My grandpa, I hope you feel better. My grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, because I never got a scene.
Besides saying some comments to them on occasion, I do not believe I can communicate with them. You know, somehow or other you feel like sometimes you're at least trying to communicate and not necessarily sure you're getting a response, but, you know, sometimes you just feel like it's the right thing to reach out. And
in terms of communicating with those who passed on, I find myself talking, if I can use that word, to my deceased mother and father fairly often, more so now that I've gotten older.
Is the road of communication with the afterlife a one-way connection? Even if we are able to reach out to them in some way, can they also reach out to us?
You see, if they remember, their mouth is closed when they're dead.
I believe somehow they communicate with us, and it's really what they hear, even though the physical part of a person is gone, then they live on as here in the mind and in the heart.
Yes, and they're possible when they're down, they're up, like they're hiding in the clouds, they can see you.
I believe that my brother talks to me. My brother died 17 years ago, and I was young and he was too young, and he talked to me through the radio, because when I'm thinking about him or needing him, a song will come on that is from him, that reminds me of him or that he sang because he was a singer. So I do believe that Philip talks to me. My grandparents don't talk to me.
Join us as we explore the shifting relationships we have with the deceased and the possibility of an eternal bond. We'll find out more in Lesson 5 of Soul Quest, The Journey Through Life, Death.
Okay, so we start with a quick recap of last week's lesson. And then, as soon as some more people come that were at last week's lesson, we're going to address questions that were brought up via email and in person. And I want to clarify some of the things. Last week, I believe, was probably the most difficult lesson to understand. There were a lot of we discussed the concept of reincarnation and about how souls split into other souls, so on and so forth. And therefore, we're going to do a significant recap on that as soon as Michael Marks asked me questions. I'm waiting for him to come, and then we'll discuss that. But in the meantime, let's do a quick recap of last week. First of all, number one, reincarnation is not recycling of an old soul, but the process of a new offshoot continuing the mission begun by a general soul. we brought up the concept of recycling doesn't sound good. When a person thinks that I have a recycled soul, in essence they're saying, we're being told that it's used, and it may be a futile effort. I mean what's going on here? Just souls keeping up, you know, in limbo and just recycling time and again. There may not be any real purpose to it. And we discussed how, on one level, a soul does continue on its journey, on its upward spiritual journey, and continues the journey of the soul on one level, because every soul comes from a root soul, and part of a soul is made up of different components, and the idea in life is to accomplish a mission, and it's not possible for a person not to accomplish at least part of that mission. So when a person accomplishes part of that mission, that part of their soul then reconnects to the root soul and ascends even further and continues on its goal. However, the parts of the soul that have not accomplished their mission then come back, together with a new infusion of energy, or a new soul of sorts. So the soul, when it reincarnates, in essence is part new, also has elements of the previous lifetime, but there's a major function of the soul that continues on its spiritual journey up forever upward. The soul is a spiritual entity, and therefore is continuously striving to become spiritually higher and higher. So the questions that were raised regarding this were, first and foremost, we discussed how the reason why a human being does not have any memory of a previous lifetime is because a major force and energy source of the new life, of the present life, is new. So the question then is, does that mean that there's absolutely no recollection, there's no connection? The answer is that on one level, the soul, or on every, the soul in essence, good evening, welcome. The soul in essence does remember. It's our physical minds and our present form in the body that cannot remember. Is it getting hot? If it does, yeah. Let's, we'll turn it off.
And if it gets cold again, we'll turn it on. Yeah, you okay with that?
So the body, in its present physical manifestation or form, cannot remember what happened in a previous lifetime, because the body was not there in a previous lifetime. The soul, which was around in a previous lifetime, on a higher spiritual realm, of course retains knowledge and memory of what happened previously. But it's not possible for our body to be in tune with that, because the body is a physical form that interacts with the soul on some level, but not on every level. The soul does retain a higher spiritual identity. So in that higher plane, the soul does have the memory. And then another question which was raised, I'll wait for Michael to come, and then we'll talk about that. Anyway, number two, souls are united in three ways. A, they stem from a single source. B, they function as many organs of a single organism, working together for a common goal. And C, they will ultimately reveal the essence that unites them all by revealing God's oneness in creation. So they have their, in simple words, a soul has its unique singular identity, while at the same time it has a common identity with something far larger than it. And three, we all share a common source and goal, but we each have our own unique identity and personal assignment within the global mission. Number four, each root soul must fulfill every mitzvah and learn all of Torah in order to reveal completely the godliness in that soul and in this portion of the world. So the root soul, of which we are a branch, becomes more complete by every single one of us completing our mission. Our mission is part of a greater mission, We're not just ships passing in the wind, in the night. And then number five, when every root soul completes this process, that is the perfection of the world and the messianic era. We are given our specific talents and possessions, and we are each guided through life based on our own unique missions. We discuss the concept of divine providence, that if something comes your way, you may think it's difficult and it may be a challenge, but ultimately this is part of your life's mission. And if a person frames difficulties in life by recognizing that this is part of what I have to do to complete my mission in life, it makes it a little easier to shoulder. Number seven, areas in life that come easily to us are those that we have already rectified in a previous Gilgul or reincarnation. Those areas that are difficult still need to be refined. Chances are that something is difficult. That means that it's incumbent upon us to get this done. If it's too easy, maybe this is not your, it's not your, not exactly your mission. And finally, understanding Gilgulim, or the concept of reincarnation, helps us see the fusion of a global plan with our personal life. We're able to see how our existence, in addition to the soul on its own, being something that's on a journey and it's been here before and is going somewhere after, in addition to that, everybody else that's found in our periphery is part of our mission, and more so, people who have come before us and people who have come after us are also part of the mission. This concept of reincarnation, right, brings people together and souls together on various levels and in different eras. And it's a global view of how ultimately everything and everybody is intertwined. There's nothing in this world, it ties into the Jewish concept that there's nothing in this world that's standalone. A person cannot, you know, there's a famous story of a person who's on a ship and the captain comes by and he notices he's drilling a hole underneath his seat. He turns to him and says, "Meshuggah, are you Meshuggah? What are you doing?" He goes, "What do you mean? I paid for the seat. It's my seat. Mind your own business. I'm drilling the hole under my seat." And the captain looks at him and says, "I'm going to toss you overboard. Don't you realize we're all in this together? Your little hole is going to kill us all." So, you know, the concept of, it's a big ship of sorts, and we're all in it together. And our actions not only affect us or our immediate family, but affects other people. And not only other people, it can affect generations past and generations to come.
How does it affect generations past?
Because if you're a reincarnation of a previous generation, depends upon what you do, yeah.
I have a question. You said, sort of as a test of whether something is part of your mission, is how difficult it is. A story you told, maybe slightly at odds with that concept, about the wealthy guy who stopped on the side of the road to help some people, versus going ahead to the party that he was supposed to go and host in. Remember what I'm talking about?
Right.
It would have been easier for him to go ahead. And that really was his calling. That was what he was better fit to do, given his station and all this kind of stuff. So he did actually do the harder thing.
Right.
Try to help the guy out again.
I guess that has to be quantified, or has to be explained. Yes, if something difficult comes your way, it's probably part of your life's mission. But not if it's futile. In other words, there has to be difficult and at the same time you're accomplishing, right? In essence, it was difficult for that person, for that wealthy man, but he wasn't accomplishing anything. Because what he was doing could have easily been done in 2 minutes by somebody who's far better at what he's doing, and ultimately would have helped the other person, and would have helped many other people. So, I mean, what you're saying, but I think this has to be looked at from different angles. Yeah, David.
I apologize if you already brought this up, having missed a couple classes, but do all souls get reincarnated?
Not necessarily. If a person completes their mission in entirety,
right. But
then
I would think more like evil. You know, the evil people, are they brought back into, I mean, do they have, I mean, horrible, evil crimes in society. Do they have another chance of life?
We brought that up, and I think at some level there are certain, we discussed a guy like Hitler, for instance.
Sorry?
We discussed Hitler, for instance.
Right.
And we discussed that there is a certain point where a person has totally destroyed their spiritual essence to a point where there is no salvation.
Yeah, these people were Nazis for all ages, so they were not...
Well, look, again, there were bad. There's bad people, and then there's evil monsters.
Well, no, saying,
bad people.
They weren't spiritual. I mean, there's spiritual people who are evil too. Look at the writing regime, or you take a pick. But and I guess I think you just answered this question a moment ago. But you're Jewish. You don't necessarily come back Jewish, do you?
Not, well, we discussed last week what you're saying may be true. We also discussed last week how a person's soul comes from a source, from a root soul,
right.
And that root soul will, if it needs to reincarnate, will reincarnate in such a way that it can come back to the root soul. So, if a root soul comes from a Jewish source, chances are that it'll be reincarnated into a Jewish source.
Maybe. And I guess my last question is that Barack Obama? Because it looks like maybe you went over that last week. It looks like from last night. You explain yourself by the big question mark.
Okay.
No comment.
All right, we're going to move on. So the opening question. Let's start with the introduction on page 81. We'll start with Mort tonight.
What happens to the love we feel for our loved ones once they are gone? Does the relationship stop short, or are there ways in which we can continue to meaningfully connect with those who have passed on? In lesson 5, we will learn that although the means of communication shift, we can continue to relate to the souls of the departed. We will learn of many ways to give our gift of love to them, and also how they continue to share of themselves with us.
So the opening questions for tonight is 1. Do we lose the connection with our loved ones when they pass on?
No, they lose connection with us, but not us with them.
Actually, we're going to discuss how it's a two-way. We can stay connected with them, and they stay connected with us. We're going
to
talk about that.
And also how they continue to share themselves with us.
Exactly. So they do. Are they aware of us and our lives? Good question.
Even if they're not, they stay in touch with us because they're in our mind. There's nothing else. If nothing else, they're in our mind.
And the fact that they're in our mind, in essence, makes them be aware of us as well. We're going to discuss that as well.
Our mind is not spiritual. It's just a factor of our consciousness. It's only physical.
I wouldn't say so much that we keep them in mind. It's more our good actions that we do that enables them to stay connected with us. In other words, our spiritual actions.
Just respond to what Steve is saying.
Right.
I have a great example of that. I know we'll get into more detail. But my dad passed away. He thought, like, everyone asked, why don't you go to a Jewish chaplain or something? That's boring. He went to the one where he had the best argument. So he was like a member of the Palestinian chaplain. That's where he got the most arguments. Anyway, so he got quite a reputation there. My brother took the torch, sort of, when he passed away, like, to go to that chaplain and have the arguments with my dad. So
he took over.
Still there, doing that when even after he passed away, sort of, through my brother.
Well, that's interesting. So what happens to the love we feel for them? That's 3. And 4, can our bond with them affect them in the afterlife? In other words, the bond that we have with our loved ones, can it affect them in the afterlife? So that's what we start with tonight. Let's now We're going to be talking about, good evening. We're going to be talking about shifting relationships, right? When you're alive and another person is alive, or we're all in this world living as fellow human beings, our relationship is on a very human interactive way. In a very human interactive way. You see a person, you're able to hug a person, you're able to talk to them, you're able to share emotions. Suddenly when a person passes on, the relationship shifts. Because you don't have the physical entity anymore. The physical entity that you are used to for decades is not here anymore. Nevertheless, while that person was here, we discussed the fact that the soul and the body together had a mission. They were given a divine mission to accomplish. And combined, this duo, body and soul, was a power couple of sorts. What they were able to accomplish, even the very angels in heaven stood in awe by what the body-soul relationship or duo were able to accomplish, were able to affect change, were able to transform darkness into light. But nevertheless, the soul, the selfless soul, was shrouded for a time by the selfish body. They got to know each other. When the soul first came to this world, it was still kind of young and pure. But over time, right, the soul starts affecting the body positively to do good deeds and to accomplish its mission. But the body also affects the soul. So on its way down, when the soul is about to come into this world and it looks at the materialistic world it's about to enter, and the body that's going to, in essence, trap it from being able to soar freely, it doesn't like what it sees. It doesn't like. It's difficult. It doesn't want to enter this this realm of constriction of sorts. So let's look at text 1a. This is what the Mishnah tells us. Text 1a.
Against your will, you must live.
So it enters this world against its will. From where the soul is coming, from its lofty soul, and from the bird's eye view as it's arrowing its way down into this physical realm, it says, whoa, this is not good. But then it enters the world because it doesn't really have a choice. It's given a mission it must accomplish, and it enters the world, and it starts creating a relationship with the body over time. They become close to each other, they grow to know each other like two friends, and they start working in tandem to accomplish their life's mission. So now let's helm text 1b.
One hour of punishment, repentance, and good deeds in this world is better than the entire life of the world to come.
So, what the soul realizes quickly is that once the body becomes of age, it's able to do good deeds, and it starts growing older, it realizes that, hey, this is a unique opportunity that I didn't have before. I'm able to actually change the world. I'm able to do things that previously were impossible to do. This world suddenly provides the soul with the ability to transform and truly change in ways that were impossible beforehand. So it starts enjoying this spiritual pursuit. It starts recognizing and realizing the beauty of every single mitzvah, the beauty of every opportunity that comes its way, that it's able to transform a negative situation into a positive. Or it's able to take a darkness and transform it into light. It becomes hooked on the mitzvah, becomes addicted to a mitzvah. That's what happens. The soul starts liking what it's accomplishing. Accomplishment is unbelievable. Makes us all feel good when we do physical accomplishments. Just imagine what the soul feels like when it's able to accomplish in the spiritual realm. But that cannot last forever, as we know. Because at some point, life comes to an end. And now what happens is, life is coming to an end, And now, the soul that didn't want to come into this world because it was afraid that it would become trapped in the world, in the materialistic world, now that same soul doesn't want to leave either, because it realizes that every moment is precious. The second it leaves this physical world, the ability to affect change is gone. It will be able to go higher and higher in the spiritual realm, but what it was able to accomplish in this world, it will never have that chance again. So as we read in text 1c, again the Mishnah continues.
And against your will you must die.
Okay, so, and against your will you must die. In other words, the soul now does not want to depart either, because it realized that once it leaves, it cannot do mitzvahs. And this is an interesting concept, because it ties in to an interesting Jewish custom. If you'll ever notice, when a person walks in to a cemetery, you'll notice all the rabbis take their tzitzis and they tuck them into their pants. My fringes, you put them into your pants. You're also not allowed to do a mitzvah in a cemetery. You don't put on tefillin or wear a talis. You don't do that in a cemetery. One of the reasons for this is because it would be looked, in essence, it's like you're taunting the soul. You're saying, look, I can do mitzvahs, and the soul feels bad because it can't. So this is one of our customs. When you walk into a cemetery, you tuck your tzitzis in, you don't put tefillin on, we don't eat or make blessings in a cemetery unless it's in within a house, an enclosed structure, because it's you know, you don't taunt the soul and tell it, look, because the soul recognizes now more than ever the value of every good deed, the value of every mitzvah. As you can see on the screen, this interesting little picture, that in this world, it's a world of transformation. And in the next world, it's a world of revelation. The difference between transformation and revelation is fundamental. Transformation is one where you can accomplish. Revelation is where all you're able to do is receive, but you yourself cannot be part of the process of change. And therefore, a human being in this physical realm is called, in Jewish terms, a mahalach. We are called a mina mahalach, or the species that we're always moving, because we're moving forward in a transformative fashion. Whereas in the next world, you're called a oimid, you're standing. You become static. Your ability to affect and change is non-existent. So now let's move ahead. We're on page 83. And we're now going to talk and discuss some of the common practices that are connected with the customary practices that are connected with those that have departed, like Kaddish, visiting the grave site, and so on and so forth. Let's read text 2.
When the child says Kaddish for his father or mother, it's like sending regards. When he learns a chapter of Mishnah on their behalf, it's like sending them a letter. And when he fulfills mitzvot and good deeds for the benefit of their souls, it's like sending them an entire package.
So the first thing that we're going to discuss is Kaddish. Everybody is familiar with Kaddish. Everybody knows when a person passes away, the first thing you do is you say Kaddish for the person. What exactly is Kaddish? Sending regards, sending a letter, sending a package. Good answer. Kaddish. Well, first of all, let's back up for a second. We just discussed that a person, when a person departs, us that are left behind, we have the ability to affect them. Which is why we say Kaddish, and we'll discuss Kaddish in a moment, what the significance of it. But what does that mean, we have the ability to affect them? It means we can change a negative situation, or increase and make better a positive one. For instance, everybody's familiar with the story of David and his son Absalom, right? How's that pronounced in English?
Absalom.
Right? Absalom tried killing his father. He was a rebellious son. He made a rebellion against him. He wanted to become the king. And ultimately he was killed. And he went, according to the Book of Kings, he went to hell, to Gehinnom. But what did his father do? His father rescued his son from Gehinnom by composing several psalms. If you look at the Book of Psalms, several psalms are written for his son Absalom. So he saved his son from purgatory by praying for him. So we see that a person can actively affect another from a negative situation, and furthermore, it can affect a person positively. So now let's talk about the Kaddish. The Kaddish, as we all know, is the prayer we say when someone passes away. There are other things that we do as well, not just Kaddish. We study Torah, we give charity, we study Torah, we give charity, we erect a monument. Okay? There's an interesting story, right? Everybody knows, after 30 days, or some people do it after a year, some people do it within 7 days, different customs, but you erect a monument. These are the things we do for the departed. So, we're going to discuss these different things one by one. First of all, we're going to start with the monument. There's a story of a family was feuding. They were arguing about what exactly to write on the monument, and they were really, they were becoming a heated discussion. They wrote a letter to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, blessed memory. They wrote him a letter saying, "We have a problem. We're not getting along. We don't know what to do." So the Rebbe writes them back a fascinating letter. He says, "You're fighting over a stone monument, and you're entirely disregarding the living monument." He says, "You are a living monument to your father, and here you're destroying the living monument for something that is really secondary and far less important, for a stone monument." He was telling them, "Look, you're getting together and living together in peace and in love and harmony is far greater to your father's soul, and will be far more to his merit than anything you can write on a piece of stone." He's telling you missed the point. So we're going to touch upon this concept of how living monuments, us, ultimately affect the souls of the departed. So, what did they decide?
Yeah.
I guess they left the blank one. I don't know what they ended up. So, in essence, the Kaddish is. Let's read it. We're going to read the Kaddish, and we're going to read the translation. Then we're going to try to decipher what exactly the purpose of this prayer is. Let's page 84. Whose turn?
Okay. You
want to
read Hebrew or?
No, in English.
Okay.
It's not Hebrew either, it's Aramaic.
Yikadam Yikadash Merabah. May he establish his kingship, give blossom to his redemption, and hasten the coming of his Messiah in your lifetime and in your days, and in the lifetime of the entire house of Israel, speedily and soon, and say, Amen. May his great name bless us forever into all eternity.
blessed and praised, glorified, exalted, and extolled. Honored, appraised, and lauded be the name of the Holy One. Blessed be He, beyond all the blessings and songs, praises and consolations that are uttered in the world. And say, Amen.
So here we have it. This is the prayer, the blessing that we say in memory of someone who passed on. Anybody see anything wrong with this prayer?
The
so
fact that it doesn't name the person who...
Does it mention anything about death? Does it mention anything about mourning? Does it say anything? Not a word. Nothing. It seems a little odd, right? So, furthermore, if there's a need, it's all about sanctifying the name, the great name of God. So there's two things here. First of all, why do we have to sanctify the name of God? Does God really need sanctification? If He's all-knowing, He's omnipotent, and He's so great, what is He needs us to tell Him how great He is? Number one. Number two, if He does need someone to tell Him how great He is, us lowly creatures, are we the ones that are really capable of doing that? In other words, we're patting God on the back and saying how great He is. It seems, so there's two befuddling issues here. Number one, this has nothing to do with death or mourning or a soul or anything. No consolation, nothing. And secondly, what is really the point of this? So the answer ultimately, I'm going to use a metaphor. What does the name of God mean? Use a metaphor of a teacup. A teacup is a vessel that enables us to get good tasting tea into our body. Now the handle of a teacup, is that necessary?
Yeah.
It enables you to hold a teacup. But is that what the teacup is? No. Teacup really, without the handle, is a teacup. But the handle is an accessory that allows us to use the cup. The name of God is similar. When God uses a name, in essence, it's the ability, it enables us to interface with God. Does it explain what God is? Not any more or less than a handle of a teacup defines a teacup. But we need that handle to be able to use the cup. Same thing, the name of God, does that define God? No. But it enables us on some level to have to interface with God. So, in essence, glorifying the name of God is symbolic of the concept of strengthening our awareness of God. So the Kaddish is all about making us more aware of God's presence. That's what it is. The Kaddish, in essence, is an opportunity to frame a person's life, what a person's life is truly about. Because the true essence of a person is to lead a meaningful life, do good deeds, and thereby have life after life. So in essence, a person's life is meant to make this, to reveal godliness, the inherent godliness that is found wherever we are. So Kaddish is a reaffirmation of what a person's life in essence should be, or what a person's life in essence was. So by saying Kaddish, what we're doing is we're revealing the central truth about the purpose of life, which has now ended. What we're saying is this life that is no more in a physical realm, we're revealing the truth of what that life was. It was all about revealing godliness and bringing forth the goodness inherent in the very realm that we live in and that this person lived in. So the Kaddish is a testimonial to the immortal soul. That's what it is. It's, in essence, it's a testimonial to the essential identity of the departed. And we're going to read text 4 now.
although only the body of the child comes from the parents, not the soul, still the soul enters this world as a result of the parents' choice to have children. Therefore, the child is righteous and serves God. It is on account of the parents who brought the child into the world. This was the reason for Abraham's strong desire to have a child, not in order to have an heir to inherit his wealth, but for the aforementioned purpose. This is the greatest merit parents can have, leaving offspring in the world who can serve God, which is in turn like the deceased themselves remaining alive and continuing to serve God since they gave birth to these children.
So when we talk about children, first of all, it's important to realize we're not necessarily talking about physical children. We're talking, because the reading we're going to read in a second clearly identifies that. When we talk about children, we're talking about, it can be spiritual children, it can be acquaintances that you have had a positive effect on. But the point here is that a person's legacy is perpetuated after life by those that are left behind and by those that follow in this person's footsteps. Let's look on the board for a second. When the Torah states, for next week's Torah portion, I believe, when it relates to Jacob's dying, it's in a few weeks actually, Rashi makes a fascinating statement. He says, Yaakov lo meis, Jacob never died. But how could that be? The Torah clearly says that he died and they embalmed him, right? What do you mean he didn't die? The Talmud asks. So the answer is, just as his children are alive, he too is alive. When we talk about his children, obviously it wasn't his 12 tribes, it's talking about us today. The fact that we, the children of Israel, of Jacob, are still thousands of years later following in his footsteps, that means he's still alive. So Judaism, in essence, puts a premium on this concept of those that have passed on continue to live through us that are still here. Now, how is that accomplished? Let's take this one step further. And this is a remarkable story of Rabbi Akiva. Very remarkable story. Who's next?
I get a long one.
Yeah. It's really a beautiful story. It's in the Talmud.
Rabbi Akiva once saw a man, darkened by coal dust, carrying an extremely heavy load of firewood on his head and running at a rapid pace. Rabbi Akiva commanded the man to stop. Rabbi Akiva said to him, "Why are you running with such a heavy load? If you are a slave, I shall free you. You are poor and must exert yourself too much, an inhuman extent. Let me give you money and make you wealthy." "Please," the man entreated Rabbi Akiva, "let me go continue my work, lest my overseers become angry with me." Rabbi Akiva asked him, "What is your work?" The man replied, "I am the soul of a dead man. Each day I am set to collect wood for a giant fire into which I am then cast." Rabbi Akiva asked, "What was your occupation in this world?" The man answered, "I was a tax collector. Took bribes from the rich and had the poor executed." Rabbi Akiva inquired, "My son, you have not heard in the other world that something might be done to help you and alleviate your suffering?" "Please," he cried, "allow me to resume my work. My taskmasters will be angry with me and punish me further. They say that I have no way of being redeemed. Had I had a child who would stand up in public and cause others to praise God through prayers or kaddish, then they could release me from this punishment. But I left a wife who was pregnant, and there is no one who would teach my child Torah, for I have no friend left in the world." At that moment, Rabbi Akiva resolved to seek out and teach this man's child. "What is your name?" "My name is Akiva. My wife's name is Shoshniva, and I am from the town of Lakia," said the man. Rabbi Akiva felt extremely pained because of this soul, and traveled until he came to that very town. He asked, "Where is this man's house?" The villagers answered in hatred, "May his bones be ground to dust in hell." "Where is this man's wife?" The villagers answered with bitterness, "May her name and memory be blotted out from this world." "Where is this man's child?" "He is uncircumcised, and no one will circumcise him." Rabbi Akiva took the man's son, circumcised him, and had begun teaching Torah. But the boy would not accept the teaching. Rabbi Rabbi Akiva fasted for 40 days on his behalf until a heavenly voice said, Rabbi Akiva, you may now teach him. Rabbi Akiva taught him Torah and to recite the Shema, silent prayer, and grace after meals. He placed the child before the congregation and he led them in prayers and the reciting of the Kaddish. Then the soul was spared from its punishment. He came to Rabbi Akiva in a dream and said, may God grant you a portion of heaven because you have spared me from the punishment of hell. From here we learn that when a child recites Kaddish, he spares his father from punishment.
Very, very, it's a fascinating, moving story. But what's important is that we see the redemption is not, and this is obviously a person who had done a lot of bad in his life. I wouldn't say he's evil beyond, you know, he's not a, but he obviously did terrible things.
Not mass murder or anything.
Right. But he did terrible things.
He did have a poor executed.
He did have the poor executed, but maybe he wasn't a mass murderer. Right? In other words, his lot in the next world pretty much was to, he had to forever purify his soul. We discussed in lesson number 2 that hell is not a punishment. It's a purification process. Some people, purification could take, you know, a long time, and this person was obviously in that mode of continuous purification, but the son was able to redeem the father. Now why is that? Because recitation of Kaddish, it's not the Kaddish itself that redeemed the father. It's causing others to do good and praise God. By his son getting up in public and praising the name of God, in essence, everybody there at the same time also is inspired. And by inspiring others, in essence, the good deeds become part of that man, that departed man's good deeds. Because people are judged not only for the actions that they themselves do, but they're also judged by actions that they cause others to do, both positive and negative. So while this person may have done a lot of terrible things himself in his life, at this point they were able to add to that judgment good deeds that he caused to happen merely by the fact of fathering the son. Right? Good deeds that he caused to happen that were then able in the afterlife to change this person's judgment. It's a very powerful concept. So even though obviously this person's life was far from exemplary, the Kaddish was able to change that. So we discussed the concept of Torah study, of Kaddish. We discussed the concept of erecting a monument. Now we're going to discuss another very powerful tool that Judaism teaches us, enables us to affect positively the life of the departed. And this tool is, can anybody guess? Torah study. Torah study can also positively affect a person in the afterlife. Let's look at text 6.
Even greater than reciting Kaddish for the sake of their souls is the study of the Holy Torah. This extricates them from all chambers of Gehinnom and eliminates a path upon which they can proceed to Ganim. There is no other mitzvah which compares to the study of the Holy Torah, particularly the study of Mishnah.
And again, I want to just backtrack a second. We mentioned that purgatory in hell in Judaism is not a punishment. It's a purification process. So doing good deeds, in essence, lessens the need for extended purification. That's what it is. And therefore, when we say Kaddish, according to our tradition, we only say it for 11 months. Because the Talmud, Medrash, I forget, says that the wicked are judged for 12 months. So we believe that by 11 months, by saying Kaddish, even if a person led a life that was far from exemplary, by the time the 11-month period is over, that any purification that was necessary is accomplished. and the soul can then ascend to a higher height. So now we just read about the concept of Torah study. Yeah. Kaddish is a uniquely Jewish prayer. For a non-Jew, I think it's equally important to do things of equal value. Good deed, charity, maybe a different prayer. Or some, of course, it's important to do whatever it is that accrues to the benefit of the soul. So Kaddish is a Jewish prayer.
So for a Jew who's trying to do this for a non-Jewish soul, how
I would suggest charitable deeds, good deeds. That, yeah. With them, what?
You could do it for your mother who's not Jewish. You could be born to a non-Jewish mother, convert to Judaism, and I'm a Jew, and your mother who's not Jewish, I mean, do it for your mother. I mean, you could take college for her.
Probably good deeds. Again, the important thing is to do something that's important for that soul. Right? The Torah was meant for the Jewish people. To do Torah study for someone, for a soul that's not Jewish, in essence, how does that connect? Charity is universal. Good deeds are universal. Positive things are universal, right? And that will affect any soul, both Jewish and non-Jewish. So I think it's more important in a scenario like that to focus on what we definitely know will work. Yeah. So now we're talking about Torah study. Mishnah. If you look at the word Mishnah, which is one of the customs, is to study the Mishnah, which is, if you look at the word, Mishnah has the same letters as Neshama, right?
We have Mem, Shin, Nun, Hey. Is everybody familiar with what the Mishnah is?
Mishnah is a body of work that was instituted or was compiled in about the year 200, and that basically is the basis of the Talmud. So everything that we know about Judaism and Jewish law and the oral law basically started with the Mishnah.
The word for soul in Hebrew is neshama, right? This is soul. It's got the same letters, you see?
Mishnah and Neshama have the same letters. So it became a Jewish custom that if it's important to study Torah, if you're going to study Torah, we study Mishnah. And we also try to study tract or verses from the Mishnah that correspond to the name of the departed. Again, this is all symbolic things that enable us to do things that are in... I just did that whole drawing, I didn't have to. This one looks nicer, huh? There you go. Okay. And then finally, we have the power of charity. We're now going to talk about the concept of Yizkor. Everybody knows that several times a year we have a special prayer for the departed. It's called Yizkor. And during Yizkor, we also commit to giving charity on behalf of the departed person. What is Yizkor? Yizkor originally was recited only on Yom Kippur, and the idea behind it was that we're begging for forgiveness for ourselves on this holiest of days. We also were meant to also ask forgiveness for the souls of the departed. That's where Yizkor started. It was then introduced to other holidays, less solemn holidays, like we say on Shmini Atzeres, which is a very happy holiday, and Passover and on Shavuos, and those three holidays. And this ties into the Jewish concept of that a soul celebrates with us when we're celebrating. There's an understanding that when under the chuppah, when a person gets married, the souls of previous generations come to celebrate. And there's an understanding that on a holiday, the souls of the previous generations also come to celebrate. So therefore, it was instituted in later years to also say the Yizkor during all major biblical holidays, in addition to Yom Kippur. Page 89, text 7. We're going to read the translation of the Yizkor.
May God remember the soul of my father, mother, my teacher, mention the Hebrew name and that of the mother who has gone to his or her supernal world, because I will, without obligating myself with a vow, donate charity for his or her sake. In this merit, may his or her soul be bound up in the bounds of life with the souls of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and with the other righteous men and women who are in God's Eden. And let us say Amen.
So the heart of this prayer is asking that this mitzvah be considered as if the deceased had done the mitzvah. So we're saying that we're the eye, we're the hands of the departed, and we're going to give charity as if they had given charity, as we see in text 8a.
What about Mali?
Kael Mali is similar. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At what time?
Oh, we say that on the yard site. The Shabbos
on the anniversary.
Anniversary, yeah. Text 8a. It's your turn. We've come full circle. Can you pass me a cup, please?
We are accustomed to pledge charity.
Okay, I get all three, huh? Okay.
We are accustomed to pledge charity on behalf of the deceased on Yom Kippur, so the deceased require forgiveness.
8b.
After we pledge charity on behalf of the deceased on Yom Kippur, how does it help the deceased once the living give that charity on their behalf? God examines the hearts of the living and the dead, and can see if the dead would have wanted to give charity themselves, and if they were poor, that they were good of heart.
So, everything we've been discussing till now clearly points towards the very powerful concept that good deeds that we do merit the souls of the departed. Charity has an added emphasis because, according to Jewish tradition, a person spends all their life or puts in all their energy into making a living. And when you give a little of that away to another, in essence what you're doing is, this is a all-encompassing mitzvah. You're taking your very essence, because you put so much energy into your livelihood, and you're giving it to another person. That's a very, very powerful concept, and therefore we give charity on behalf of the departed, and that accrues to their merit. So, until now, we've been discussing how we can affect the departed. Now what we're going to start discussing is how they affect us, the other side of the coin. How can the departed affect us? We're on page 91. We're going to start with a learning activity. Write the answers to these questions in your book and be prepared to defend them. Who's writing this? One asked. So question number one, would you rather go to a wedding or a funeral?
Interesting question, because you notice, I don't know, but there's a lot of stories about how weddings bring out the worst in people and funerals bring out the best in people.
You're taking away my thunder. No, it's okay. I like that. Well, let's, you know, what would you rather go to? We're going to ask people to share with us. Question number two. Which is the more meaningful and spiritual experience, and why? This is a little more difficult to answer. So anybody want to share with us?
I'd say it depends. It does. I mean, certainly a funeral is a very spiritual experience, because it really provides an opportunity to really look at your inner self and do some soul searching. And that also can be helped prove in a wedding as well, I think, because, you know, maybe you're not where you want to be in life when something happens, and it's nice to partake in someone else's joy. Maybe you want to be a part of it and also reflect too. But I think in general, a funeral
said. I think that's a sentiment I would share. Anybody else want to...
The one thing I think I would add would be that the funeral, you're thinking of your own mortality.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Shouldn't say this, but at the wedding, maybe you're thinking like a purgatory. You know what's going to be coming. And if you've been marrying Hedwig, that's your body, you ever had a phone.
Anyway.
I would say a wedding. I know I'm already wrong.
Now, which would you rather be at?
Wedding.
Oh, okay.
Because
on one level, a wedding, right. But let's talk about the other. I think the more fundamental question here is, which do you find more spiritual or meaningful?
A wedding.
A wedding?
Yeah, because I mean, they're both, that's almost like comparing apples and oranges. So, I would really say neither. But if I had to force, you know, if I had a gun in my head and I had to choose one, an answer, I would say a wedding, because a wedding is celebrating the beginning. Well, I guess the death is the passage of something, that's the beginning too.
Exactly.
But this is the beginning in life, where we are. It's something that makes possible new beginnings. You know, now a married couple, they can bring new souls into the world. It's joyous. The fact that a wedding maybe brings out the cattiness or the pettiness of people, if that's true, and a funeral brings out the best of people, that's just because that's an inclination. That's not a requirement. You know, you don't have to be good at wedding, at funeral, and bad at wedding. You know, it can be good at weddings too.
I don't think there's really a wrong or right answer here. I think the purpose of this exercise was to, you know, when you, you know, it kind of gets you thinking, how would you compare a wedding with a funeral? These are two very different functions. And how could we even, you know, say that a person will find, I mean, the idea of this is to get us thinking that maybe there is something meaningful to a funeral. And maybe there is something we can learn, fundamental thing we can learn from a funeral. What is that? So let's look at text 9, and we're going to read from King Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived. And he kind of lays it out over here. Whose turn?
Come on.
Cool, sir.
You're up at bat.
Oh, okay. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart.
So he says something very powerful. He says in Ecclesiastes, as you can see on the board, V'hachai yitein aliboy, and the living shall take to heart. Many of you may be familiar with, I think we discussed him in the past class, a person by the name of Randy Pausch. Remember, he was a big, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, he was a big YouTube phenomenon. This was the guy, the professor, I think, in Stanford, maybe? Or MIT, where was he? I forgot where he was, Stanford. And he basically gave, you know, he knew he had pancreatic cancer or something, he knew he was dying. He had a 3-year-old kid, and he made a movie or a YouTube thing for his kid.
The Last Talk or something?
The last, you know, because every professor gives their, it was very moving. He died about 8 months ago. But it was very moving because, you know, he said, look, you know, at the end of life, all you think about is the legacy and how I can affect those that are left behind. That was the whole gist of everything he was saying. It was all about passing it on, you know, leaving others behind you that you made a fundamental difference in their lives.
Legacy.
And then you've affected others in such a way that they will in turn affect others and they will actually change their life. But what King Solomon is telling us here is fundamental. He's saying that death, in essence, can teach us a lot more than some very happy occasions. And why is he saying that? Because death is very powerful. It's a very moving, painful experience, right? When you're the one left on this side of the fence. But nevertheless, it's powerful and moving. And it can prompt us, as you were saying before, it can prompt us to make meaningful changes in our own lives, because it gets us to think about our own mortality, about how the clock is ticking, and we have a mission, and time is running out. You never know. So mourning, in essence, is a time to acknowledge loss on one hand, but on the other hand, mourning is a reminder to examine our own lives and make our lives better. It's a reminder of the need to focus on our mission in life, and if not for death, humans would arguably be arrogant, self-absorbed, and infinitely proud creatures. The fact that we know that we're just here for a while, we're here for the ride, in essence, keeps us in check. It reminds us that there's a spiritual purpose, there's a spiritual goal, and the need to be in tune with that. So let's look at text 10, and we see how Maimonides puts this a little clearer.
One who does not mourn as prescribed by our sages is a callous individual. Rather, a mourner should be anxious and concerned and evaluate his behavior and repent.
So the mitzvah to mourn is one, to mourn, two, to remember, and number three, to be inspired. Because often we all have, you know, we all live, it's called, you know, the day-to-day grind. You get up in the morning, you gotta fight traffic, you gotta go to the market, the little things kind of make up our lives. And it's not that often that a person actually stops to tackle the big picture and think about why we're here. What am I doing? Where am I heading? People don't do that very seldom, because the day-to-day minutia basically takes up our lives. And that's what ends up happening day in, day out. And then every once in a while there's a powerful event in our lives that suddenly tells us, stop, think, remember, there's a big picture. And it reminds us to keep it in mind and to focus on the big picture. And that's what a death does. It sobers us up and reminds us to take life to heart. As King Solomon said, Achai Yitim Elivoy. The living must take to heart and remember what it is that we're here for. And we have to stop taking things for granted. Sometimes we take the very life that we live, that we get up in the morning and go to sleep at night, and that we're able to get up in the next morning, we take it for granted. At a funeral, you stop taking that for granted. You recognize how precious life is every moment.
So every same one day at the end.
Right? And that's why, according to Jewish custom, it's a mitzvah to mourn. It's a mitzvah. There's a story with the Rebbe again, where he sent somebody on his behalf to comfort somebody whose father had passed away. And the Rebbe made it interesting, because he told him to tell that person on my behalf that as every single mitzvah must be done with happiness, mourning must be done with happiness as well. Well, that's a very odd statement to make. How could you mourn and be happy? And the answer is, he wasn't telling him to get up and start dancing and be joyous. He was telling him to be happy that he had an opportunity for introspection, an opportunity to become inspired, an opportunity to perfect his life and become a better person. It's a good thing when a person has an opportunity to do that. So ultimately, it's a mitzvah to mourn, because it inspires us and moves us towards becoming better people. Let's look at text 11.
This was written by the Rebbe.
Yeah.
One might argue that after the soul has risen and elevated, rising level above spiritual level, it no longer desires to descend and return to the lower, corporeal worlds.
That's
the corporeal
world.
Yeah.
Real. That means the physical, right? Physical one.
By its very nature, the soul desires only to rise. However, the truth is that an asset in and of itself is not yet perfection. With the sublimation and elevation, there must be an influence below. The soul actually desires that through its spiritual elevation there will be an increase of good acts in the lower worlds. This includes those deeds, this includes those good deeds, Torah, prayer, and charity that are performed for the sake of bringing the elevation to the soul. In general, we speak of the principle that the living must take to heart in order for the resulting actions on the part of the living to bring not only elevation to the soul in the supernal worlds, but also for the influence that it has on the lower worlds.
So the soul actually desires and yearns for positive change in us. So, we were talking before about how we affect positively, and how the soul itself looks back and says, I want to see positive change as a result of my actions in the physical realm. So, in other words, there is some connection. We'll talk about this a little more, how there is some level of connection that is always found here. So ultimately, we look above and try to unravel the mystery of the netherworlds, right? And they look below, knowing that we hold the key to that mystery in our hands. So we're looking at them, and they're looking back at us. So in essence, there's a two-way connection, the fundamental connection of the eternal soul with our eternal soul that is still within a living body. And we're now going to talk about the Yahrzeit. Once a year, on the anniversary of passing, that's considered to be a special day. The word Yahrzeit literally means, Yiddish, means the time of year. Yahrzeit. Yahr means year, Zeit means time. That time of year, the anniversary of a person's death. As we've just been discussing, that the relationship between living and departed continues after death. A special time for this relationship is the anniversary of the date of passing. And why is that? Let's look at text 12.
For as is known, all the effort of man, in which his soul toiled during his lifetime, and which remains above in a hidden and concealed state, is revealed and radiates in a manifest way, from above downwards at the time of his passing.
So, this whole concept of us affecting the soul, and the soul affecting us, becomes ever more present one day a year, and that is on the anniversary of the passing. Because according to the Zohar, we're going to read in a moment, on that day the soul radiates far more than on any other day, because this is a day that it ascends to a higher realm. And this spiritual radiance affects all those that were connected with this person, family, friends, anybody that was affected by this person has a special connection on that day. And therefore we can powerfully affect the soul on that day, and at the same time the soul can powerfully affect us in return. And why on this day specifically? What's special about the anniversary? The anniversary is a completion. Only once a task is complete can you look back and reflect upon it and enjoy it. Similar to, say, the Shabbos. Shabbos is the end of a weekly cycle. After a whole week of toiling and working, on the seventh day you're able to look back and say, I accomplished, good, let me rest. So the same thing as anniversary is kind of a coming full circle. When you come full circle, you're able to, in essence, reflect upon it and enjoy it. So that's why the yearly cycle is something that's fundamentally special. Let's look at text 13.
Are you saying that a time element on that side also?
Yeah.
I thought time is only on this side.
Time is always connected to a soul on some level, because a soul is always connected to this world on some level. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. So therefore, it will always be affected by time the way we understand.
But remember we discussed the last class, each of these us are really these spark souls and spark off these different values and main souls, or
we're going to be discussing this in a moment. The whole what level continues up and what level stays. So let's look at text 13.
Your sight is generally associated with two mixed feelings. On one hand, we learn from our sages that the soul of the departed rises from one spiritual world to a higher one. This is therefore a day of rejoicing for the soul, hence a day of corresponding joy for the near and dear ones left behind. On the other hand, the archetype naturally emphasizes the loss sustained by the family, which results in a feeling of sadness. In truth, however, the archetype should not call forth beyond the sadness, but rather a feeling of reflection, self-examination, and repentance. During this day, one should work to align one's life on this earth with the path followed by the soul above, which is constantly on the ascent. This is to say, just as the soul continuously rises year after year, going from strength to strength, so must be those associated with the soul steadily rise in Torah knowledge and the observance of the soul. By doing so, they give the soul of the departed the greatest possible joy. This approach underlines the basic view of Judaism that in reality there is no death in matters of godliness. Rather, the archetype and even the very day of passing represent a transition. But this transition is unique, for it goes in only one direction, higher and higher, from strength to strength, first in this world and later in the following.
So, what we see from this reading is clearly a yahrzeit is a day, it's a positive day. It's a day that, on one hand, we're introspective, we remember the person, but it's a happy day. And there are several customs that are generally associated with this day. It's a custom to try to get an aliyah, to be called up to the Torah, on the day, the Shabbos before, or if the yahrzeit is on a Monday or Thursday on that day, try to be called up to the Torah. There's the concept of lighting a candle, because a flame always strives to go higher. It's always, and therefore that's similar to the soul. Just as fire strives upward, the soul does the same. There's also a custom to make a little festive, you know, to have cake and mashke, right? To say l'chaim, vodka, whiskey, to say l'chaim, you know, because it's a happy day, right? We're drinking for, you know, for the positive aspirations of the soul. So we say l'chaim, we drink a little. It's a very Jewish custom.
We celebrate life.
We're celebrating the soul and its radiance on this special day, and the fact that it's able to ascend to a higher level. That's what we're celebrating. That's why we say l'chaim. What do Jews do when you celebrate l'chaim? It's a happy occasion. We give charity, as I mentioned before. We study Torah. We say the Mishnah, and then we visit the grave. There's a custom to visit the grave site and say psalms. We're going to talk about this a little. Now, next section, visiting the grave site, section number 5.
The soul of man is called
by
God.
Visiting the grave site is done for several reasons. First and foremost, it's a sign of respect. You're showing that you have not forgotten about them. There's a Jewish custom when you go to a grave site, you leave a little pebble on top. Again, it's a sign of the next person who comes, sees the pebble, knows that someone else was here. That's a sign that we haven't forgotten. The people that are not with us are still important. And this ties into the spiritual importance, because we believe in the spiritual everlasting identity of this person. And there's a... let's look at text... Before we read text 14, I'm also going to touch upon something else. There's a custom to pray at the graveside of a tzaddik, right? Every person prays at the graveside of a loved one, father, mother, brother, sister. But then there's a custom to go to a tzaddik. Anybody who's ever been to Israel, there's a custom to go to, for instance, the great Talmudic scholar, Amir Bal Hanes, to go to the graveside of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. To go to the gravesite of King David, that's right outside the old city, it's in the old city of Jerusalem. And this ties back, especially during troubling times. When there's been trouble amongst the Jewish community, it's a thousands of years, this custom has been around thousands of years, we go to the gravesite of a tzaddik, and we're going to discuss this in a moment. But a cemetery generally, when a person thinks about a cemetery, you associate it with finality. But Judaism says no. On the contrary, a cemetery should be associated with an uplifting experience. It's about spiritual uplifting. It's not about finality. You know, there's a story told about a guy who types into his GPS. He's going to a cemetery, and he stays right turn, left turn, and finally he reaches the cemetery, and the thing goes, "You've reached your final destination." The guy, what? So, what's that?
I was thinking that joke in the airlines. Welcome to, with LaGuardia Airport, if this is your final destination, go all the way to Gato.
Exactly. But, but obviously Judaism does not associate cemeteries with a final destination. It's the beginning of the next leg of a journey, and it's also should be a spiritually uplifting experience for those of us who are still here. So why do we visit a gravesite? And the Zohar explains, let's read text 14.
The soul of a man is called by three names, Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama. The Nefesh is present in the grave, and it roams this world to be among the living, and to be acquainted with their pain. At a time of need, it pleads for mercy for them. And when the inhabitants of the world are in need, when they are in sorrow and they go to the cemetery, the Nefesh awakens. It goes and floats and awakens Ruach, and the Ruach is awakened at the place of the patriarch. It ascends and arouses the Neshama. Then the Holy One, blessed be He, has mercy on the world as we have already established.
So in essence, a gravesite serves as a communication port of sorts, because there's always a level of a soul, the lowest level, that will always be present. Even after the body is totally decomposed, there's a concept that the Zohar refers to as Havlei Degarmei, the vapor of the bones. That's what it's called. It's a certain level of the soul that will always be there. And the concept of going to a gravesite will always be found in that specific location. So when you go to a gravesite, it's not that this lower level of the soul is able to communicate with its higher counterpart, that's able to communicate with its higher counterpart, that's able then to, our belief system tells us, push prayers to where they are accepted. So,
what is this lower level of soul?
The lowest level that's
what
always remains. We ask, what is it? What?
Yeah.
It's some kind of spiritual existence. I don't know. I've never seen a soul. I know it exists, but I've never seen one. And anybody who ever tells you they have seen one, you know you're in trouble.
Yeah.
What we're talking about, something that we can't even conceptualize.
There's the whole concept of spirituality is something we can't conceptualize.
Yeah, you can conceptualize a soul, but we sliced and diced the soul. Sparks are going here, and then there's levels of stains.
So you ask me how it physically looks?
No.
It's
what's
physically.
Left? Is there a consciousness to what's left?
Well, obviously, because it's able to. I understand your question. The level of the soul that's left is able to sense the presence of your being there, to the extent that if it sees that you're in trouble and it feels that you need you need some kind of help from up above, it will then communicate with its higher counterpart, which will then create a chain reaction. So obviously it's a powerful level of the soul. Is it the most powerful? No, because it's still here in the physical world.
So they have some form of consciousness,
if
it could, pain.
Yeah, it has some kind of consciousness. It senses a person being there, absolutely. Yeah.
But does the soul remain where the body is? No.
It remains where the body is. The Zohar uses a term of the lowest level. So there was this soul that always remains there. It uses the terminology, like I mentioned before, vapors of the bones. That's what it calls it.
What if the body is no longer there, like cremation?
Bones will always. That's one of the reasons why Judaism is against cremation. Doesn't destroy the soul, but part of first of all, everything we've been discussing is a process. Decomposition in the soul, it's all a process. So by cremation, basically circumvents everything.
At some point, the bones go too. I mean, at some point.
They say that there's one little bone, it's called there's one that will never disappear. It never disappears. It's referred to as the etzem luz, a loose bone.
Actually,
scientifically, they say there, even in the crematoria, there's some element that couldn't that would survive even the cremation.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was destroyed.
There's one element that I think always remains. It's indestructible, I believe it's indestructible. Again, we have to check with a scientist, but I believe that there is one part of the human body.
Somebody's committed. It's just ashes. They put them in a little burn.
But I think that's what they give the person. I think there is one, maybe some of it that they don't.
Well, even if the bones were totally gone, that's the vapors of the bones. They don't stay in the bones.
Right. 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 Anyway, so now getting back, so in essence what we're saying is that the gravesite is a communication port of sorts, and the soul remains even after it decomposes on some level, as it benefits from being here as much as we do. Just like we benefit from the soul being able to communicate, it benefits as well from being able to feel the presence of those that it knew in this lifetime and being able to recognize that these people are doing good things on its behalf. Now, again, it's important to recognize that Judaism is adamantly against the concept of praying to dead people. It's a clear biblical prohibition. It's called Deir Shalameisim. You are not allowed to pray to a dead person. And that's not what is done when you go to a grave. What we're doing is we're saying psalms, and we are not praying to a dead person. We're praying for the soul of the person, and that soul is able to sense if we're in trouble, and thereby it's able to communicate and then hopefully intercede on our behalf. But the concept of praying to a dead person is idolatry, according to Judaism. So there's a big distinction there. So even when we go to a cemetery and to a gravesite of a holy person, like King David, or Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in Israel, or even Chassidim, whenever I go to New York, I go to the gravesite of the Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory, right? Because he was a tzaddik, a great person. It's important to remember that the reason we're going there is not, God forbid, to pray to a departed person. It's to pray on our behalf, for ourselves, right, and for the soul, and we hope that the soul will then intercede on our behalf. And again, this is an age-old custom. This millions of people, yearly Jews, go to all different types of gravesites of holy people. So fine, let's read text 15.
When there are wise and pious people of a generation who have the merit of receiving the divine spirit upon them, through them the rest of the people of the generation can also benefit from that supernal spirit. This is not only true in the lives of these lofty individuals, but even when they have passed on. This lofty spirit is to be found at their grave sites. For their very bones were the vessels upon which this lofty spirit rested, and some of this remains enough to benefit those that avail themselves of it.
So we're going to end tonight with sixth section, we're going to talk about God's candle. A very reoccurring theme has been the concept of a flame, a candle, a yahrzeit. We light a candle. And the reason here is because on the yahrzeit, on the day, the anniversary of passing, the soul, in essence, is granted permission to come back to this world and observe in a more powerful state all its legacy, all the people that are doing good deeds on its behalf. And the soul specifically derives great pleasure from a candle. And why is that? Because a candle, its emphasis is on the belief of the immortality of the soul. Let's look at text 16.
The souls of Israel have been hewn from the holy lamp, as it is written, "The spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord." Now, once this lamp has been kindled from the supernal Torah, the light upon it never ceases for an instant, like the flame of a wick which is never still for an instant. So when an Israelite has said one word of the Torah, a light is kindled, and he cannot keep still, but sways to and fro like the flame of a wick.
Text 17.
The soul is hewn from the light of the divine intellect, and therefore the soul experiences enormous joy in the presence of life.